Many consider the parable of the prodigal son to be the very best story in the Bible. It appears only in the Gospel of Luke, in the 15th chapter, which actually contains a trinity of parables. The first is about a lost sheep and the shepherd who leaves 99 perfectly obedient other sheep to go find the one who has wandered away. The second parable has to do with a lost coin and a woman who lights a lamp and sweeps the floor and searches high and low, even though she has 9 gleaming pieces of silver tucked away safely in her pocketbook. She searches until she finds the one that is lost. And then, of course, there is the story of the lost son, who goes away to the far country and gets into all kinds of trouble and finally comes to himself, returns to his father, who welcomes him back with an embrace, a kiss, a robe, a ring, an exuberant celebration, the celebration being offered much to the chagrin of the older brother, who has never gone anywhere and has always tried to do everything right. For centuries, tradition has called this 15th chapter of Luke the little gospel. It's all there, the essence of everything one needs to know about the magnitude and the persistence of the grace of God. Jesus tells these 3 parables to the Pharisees and the scribes, who are becoming increasingly irritated with Jesus because of his, what shall we say, lack of taste. This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them. They grumble to one another. It is their haughty disdain that frames the 3 stories, but it is an opposite mood that permeates the stories. The shepherd lays that lost sheep on his shoulders, rejoicing. The woman calls in her friends and neighbors and says, "You won't believe this. Come, rejoice with me. I've found what I had lost." And the father hires a band and kills the fatted calf so that everyone may come and eat, dance, and make merry. This reminds me of the old story of the Sunday school teacher who shared the story of the prodigal son with her Sunday school class one day. They were 6-year-olds. She described in some detail the mess the younger son had gotten himself into and how the father had welcomed him back when he returned. And she said, "Children, at the end of the story, there's a wonderful party with singing and dancing and lots of food. Everyone is very happy. All but one character in the story. Who do you think was unhappy?" The little girl raised her hand and said, "I think the saddest one in that story must have been the fatted calf." I think the elder brother could have given the calf a run for his money in the sadness department. But I do agree with those scholars who suggest that the better name for this story would be the parable of the father's love rather than the parable of the prodigal son, because the central actor in the story, the one who determines the outcome, is the father, the one who welcomes, the father who forgives, the father who prefers reconciliation to retribution, who offers unconditional, undeserved grace. The story must have sounded ridiculous to the first century Middle Eastern fathers to whom Jesus originally told the parable, because fathers were to be obeyed, to give their children nothing more or nothing less than they had earned or deserved. Family honor was sacred, and what could be more dishonorable to a Jewish family than to have a son who had gone to the far country and who had fed pigs owned by Gentiles? The parable of the father's outrageous love. There is a wonderful painting that captures perhaps a more nuanced truth about this parable. It is the famous painting by Rembrandt that hangs in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, Russia. In the painting, the father welcomes the guilt-ridden son home by laying his hands upon the son's shoulders as his son is kneeling before him. Henry Nouwen spent weeks studying the painting, and he kept realizing that his attention was being drawn back again and again to the father's hands. In the painting, Nouwen writes, the light is concentrated on the hands, and so the eyes of the bystanders are focused on the hands. In those hands, mercy becomes flesh. Through those hands, not only the tired son, but also the grieving, worn-out father seems to find their rest. As Nouwen studied the hands of the father in the painting, he discovered something that others had perhaps never seen before. The closer I looked, the clearer it became to me that Rembrandt had done something quite different from letting God pose as the wise old male head of the family. The two hands, I realized, were different from each other. The left hand touched the son's shoulder. It seemed strong and muscular, the fingers spread out, covering a large part of the shoulder and back. You can sense a certain pressure, especially in the thumb. The hand seems not only to touch, but with its strength also to hold, though there is gentleness. The father's left hand grips firmly. A powerful portrait of a father's hand. A reminder of the importance of fathers and the need for a father's strong love in the lives of children. I learned last week that tomorrow is a special Saints Day for Catholics and Episcopalians. I know we're all focused on St. Patrick's Day just passed, but tomorrow is St. Joseph's Day, honoring the father of Jesus, who taught his son how to drive a nail all the way home, who loved his son with a strong, manly kind of love. The father's love. And yet, the right hand is different from the left in the painting by Rembrandt. It is softer, refined. The fingers are close to one another. They have an elegant quality. The right hand lies gently upon the son's shoulder. It appears to be offering comfort and consolation. Nouwen says that to him it is the mother's hand, perhaps like the hand of Mary, the mother of Jesus, who loved her son with a strong yet tender love. There is a kind of love that only women can offer their children. One of the strongest memories I have of my ministry, which is now almost 30 years old, is the first Easter season, I served at a church downtown at Central Church. My office was just off of Washington Street. And behind Central Church is the Catholic Church, the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. One afternoon, I was sitting in my office late. The door to my study flung open out on the front, on the door. The sign read, Associate Pastor. Standing at the door was a desperate-looking man. He looked at me, did a double take, looked back at the sign on the door, then looked back at me and said, Father, will you hear my confession? Our Presbyterian Confession of Faith captures the fullness of the nature of God. We will read these lines in a moment. Like a mother who cannot forget her nursing child, like a father who runs to welcome the prodigal home, God is faithful still. The parable of the loving Father who loves us as a father and as a mother, the fullness of God. There are three actors in the story, of course, the father, the lost younger son, the older duty-bound son. Some of us identify, I know, with the prodigal. We have been in our lives to some sort of far country or another and lost ourselves. Writer Nora Gallagher says that she gave up smoking during Lent, and she remembers how on the Ash Wednesday of the year she quit, a friend had said to her, Anne is giving up drinking, Terry's giving up chocolate, and me, I'm just giving up. The prodigal son gave up on his own worthiness, but then he came to himself. He woke up, not through some dramatic religious experience, but because he had just reached the end of being where he was. And he chose to get back up and get a hold of himself, to go home, and to try to be a person that was not self-destructive. I love this prayer written by a Nigerian Christian. God in heaven, you helped my life to grow like a tree, but then something happened. Satan, like a bird, carried one twig of his own choosing after another, and before I knew it, he had built a dwelling place in me and was living in it. But tonight, I'm throwing out both the bird and the nest. There comes a time when we have been to the far country, when we say enough. And we find ourselves, and in the process, we find ourselves to be the recipient of a healing, restorative grace we had not known existed. But first, we have to get a hold of ourselves. Some of us identify with the prodigal, others with the elder brother, the responsible one, the duty-bound son, the one who tries to do the right thing, but for whom nobody ever throws a party. Is the elder brother who gets so angry over the welcoming grace the father offers the prodigal is Jesus trying to make the elder brother the villain in the piece? I don't think so. Because if the elder brother is the villain, then most of us, most of you who are firstborn siblings, for example, would be in a lot of trouble. I'm a secondborn child in my family, but my parents usually treated me as if I were the firstborn, and I really have all my life felt responsible for just about everything. I wonder if any of you can identify. If the elder brother is the villain, then who in the life of the church would be willing to serve on the church finance committee or turn out the lights when the fellowship supper is over? The church would have to close down if the elder brother syndrome ever disappeared. The problem is that we responsible ones can get a little bit self-righteous, can we not? We can decide not only what we want to do, but what others ought to do, and there is just one little step from that posture to our deciding how God ought to act, and whom God ought to favor, and whom God not ought to favor. Peter Gomes of Harvard's University Church writes, "The poor father, he has two sons. One is selfish and self-indulgent. The other, self-righteous. Perhaps the father should run away and let the two boys fight it out." Whether we consider ourselves to be stalwart citizens or returned wayfarers, we cannot help but receive this parable about redemption with astonished and grateful hearts. I do not believe, in fact, that either of us are actually one way or the other. Sometimes I am responsible, and other days I am not taking good enough care of myself. Sometimes I'm reckless. Sometimes I overdo. Sometimes I underdo. What this parable says is that it really doesn't matter what you do. What matters is that there is nothing you have to do to earn or deserve the gracious favor and love of God. It comes from God's own heart and God's own nature. You are worthy of God's gracious love, no matter what. Our retreat leader said to us yesterday, "The one thing you need to know about me is that I know for certain that I am loved by God." To be able to not only hear that through our ears, but live that in our heart is the most transformational thing we can do as human beings. It sounds absurd that God's grace is so extravagant, so unrelated to whether we have earned it or not. It sounds absurd. But I'll tell you what else is absurd: the sight of Jesus, the one who tells us this story, the sight of him pouring out his life, all of it, pouring it all out on the cross for no good reason except for love that will not let us go. I hope you know how greatly you are loved. I hope you know how greatly you are loved. If you ascend to heaven, God is there If you make your bed in hell, God will be there too. If you take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there, God's hand will lead you, and God's right hand will hold you fast. Can I close with a story? In the 1990s, I went to China. And one Sunday, I worshiped in a Presbyterian church in Beijing. The pastor of that church, interestingly enough, was a woman. It's a very impressive congregation. She is one of the leading theologians in China. Her parents were prominent members of the Communist Party. And when she became a Christian, her mother and her father utterly disowned her. She went to California, the daughter did, to study theology. And while she was there, she received word that her mother was quite ill. She called her mother in Beijing. They talked for an hour and had a sense of reconciliation. Her mother died the next day. I was with this Presbyterian pastor 25 years after the fact. And she told a whole group of strangers this intimate story about her mother and their reconciliation and how that telephone call was the most grace-filled moment of her life. And then she looked at us and she said, "I became a Christian for two reasons. First, because someone invited me to go to church. Remember, we're in China. And I saw how loving people were to one another. And then someone gave me a Bible and I read the greatest story I had ever read in my life." And I wondered if when she opened her Bible, it might not have opened to the 15th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. While he was far off, his father saw him, and his father was filled with compassion, and he ran out and put his arms around his son, and he kissed him, and he said, "Get the fatted calf, and let us eat and celebrate, for this child of mine, he was dead, and now he's alive again. This child was lost, and now is found." Thanks be to God for this reading from his holy word.